Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt, the Gear and Lifestyle Editor for Inside Lacrosse. And today, as always, I am joined by the illustrious
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Yes, sir. We have made it to the end of the road. Cue up the Boys to Men to walk us through it. Before we get started, just want to thank everybody that's rocked with us all season. We really appreciate you. We love the feedback for the podcast. We love doing it. We're sad to see it come to an end, but we've got a great show for you guys, starting with the first semifinal, which Chris will recap. Chris, what was that game?
Chesapeake Bayhawks 14, Atlanta Blaze 13. So the first thing starts off with this one for me. Atlanta tossed out a couple different looks to kind of get the Bayhawks on their toes. You had Mark Matthews starting at attack. When we last saw him, he was heading up that midfield unit, which you got to move somebody out from that spot. So they switched Tommy Palasek out, running out the box, going with the midfielders, and he's drawing short sticks to start. Also, as we discussed last week right here on the podcast, Chesapeake ends up going with a short stick covering Shane Jackson. And pretty much all game, there was a couple times where they kind of drifted and had a pole down there. But, you know, 9 out of 10 times, they just had a short stick down there, be it, you know, Matt Abbott, Isaiah Davis Allen, somebody like that. And it ended up working very well. Shane Jackson was silent pretty much all game long. Chesapeake jumped out to a 2-1 lead thanks to what I thought was some really strong ride work, forcing some Atlanta turnovers, just kind of getting them off balance, not letting them get comfortable. But then seems like the Blaze got real loose real quick. TJ Camizio sent this bounce pass over to Mark Matthews. Mark Matthews ran by everybody, as he did a couple times on this particular evening, and tied it up. And then they started taking things over. Blaze go on a little run, score 5 of the next 6 goals. We were talking about the face-offs potentially, if Woodall had run out of gas or something like that. Nope, he ends up winning 9 of the first 15 in the first half. And then the Bayhawks are a team heading to halftime that kind of looks like they're on the ropes. Now, here's the thing. It's going to sound familiar. The third quarter. That pesky darn third quarter gets the Atlanta Blaze yet again. We mentioned this during the little preview you might have seen on the old website about this game, but Atlanta's past 4 losses now include 2 third-quarter shutouts, 1 third-quarter where they're outscored 7-3, and this particular third quarter where the Bayhawks beat them 6-1. They had a 9-4 lead at halftime, and by the time fourth quarter comes around, they're tied at 10. Toss in 17 turnovers for the Blaze in the second half, and one in overtime. Which is definitely not the time you want to have a turnover, compared to just 7 for the Bayhawks. And, that's all she wrote. That's really what it came down to. It's that third quarter that gets them again. I did want to ask you this. Third quarters, do you think this is the product of, how much of this is just a coincidence? Do you think it's defenses tossing something out that they're not used to? And is it taking them a long time to adjust? Is some of it just the dumb luck being that particular quarter? You think it's maybe something literally them hanging out during the halftime and, you know, maybe they have to switch up what they're doing during the break? What do you think all gets into this sort of dragging third quarter from them?
I just think it's funny because they're not the only team it's happened to, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen this – we've seen it from all three of the other teams in the playoffs too. Just depending on different parts of the season. And the difference is those teams have kind of, made some adjustments and not necessarily like turned it all the way around and had like strong thirds and strong fourth quarters. But they've, with the exception of the Cannons, have made way less mistakes, right? And that's the key here, is it's mistakes. And when you make a lot of mistakes, I think you can only blame focus. Like, I think you can, when it happens this often, you have to look at the focus of the entire team. Where is it? Where is it gone? Why isn't it here anymore? Is kind of irrelevant because it just hasn't shown up. And that's why the Blaze lost here. And it's also why another team lost in the semis and the final. So I don't know. I think it's interesting to kind of pick at what happens to teams at halftime, because it's one of those things that people talk about a lot in all sports, is like, oh, that you came out of the third quarter, great. That's like the first question you get asked on the sideline after the game's over when you win. Oh man, you guys came out and you did great and you beat that other team. I mean, no one's asking the other team what happened. They're asking the team about adjustments that won, not the team that lost. And they're doing that because no one likes to interview the loser. And I just think it's a lack of focus, totally lack of focus.
Yeah, you rarely hear about, you know, boy, you guys really kind of dragged when you came out. What weren't you doing in that locker room, you know, at halftime? So I do want to mention, oh, yeah, yeah, and you mentioned that the this happened to all the teams at some point this season. You know, the Blaze, in the time they did beat the Bayhawks, they shut them out in the third quarter, too. So, yeah, anybody can get it on any given day. I do want to mention this one particular Bayhawk, however. How about Ryan Tucker? Out of nowhere, unthawed from the ice, coming off the top rope. So Tucker plays six games this season and scored a total of 6 points. That's 5 goals and 1 assist. This guy suits up this weekend, you know, much to a lot of people's surprise, I would imagine. He's not really been that active a participant. Suits up this weekend, scores 2 goals in this game, and then he wins the Corum Players' Choice Award, which is basically the Teammate of the Year Award, at the MLO Honors the following night. This guy, the man that the Blaze themselves traded back to Chesapeake for Greg Kaholin a little while ago, comes back to haunt their nightmares like Freddy Krueger and becomes one of the weekend's sneaky great stories. So now we do have the weekend of Tucker, but I wanted to ask you, in addition to the big-time stories that this weekend had, you know, and there were a lot of superstars playing and all that, as far as, like, little things, weird things, whatever, did anything stick out to you as funny, memorable, any unsung hero kind of stuff that you might take away from this whole weekend?
I mean, do you have a half hour to talk about TJ Kamizio?
I do, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I know you do, but, like, I'll just shorten it to I think he's amazing. I think he's one of the best defensive midfielders in the world. I really do. And not just at playing defense. He's one of the best at doing the things that don't show up. And he's on the same team as a guy that does the same thing. And we've talked about him here before. Christian Mazzone, the pride of Rutgers. Dude works harder than an extra in a Scorsese movie to make the scene work. And it's funny we talk about those two guys. They're on the losing team here. But there is a lot to love about certain parts of this Atlanta squad. And I think it kind of sucks that they didn't win. But on the other side of the ball, you can't talk about this game or the semifinals or the championship without talking about the Bayhawks. And I have to praise the entirety of the Longsticks that wore Bayhawk blue, because I don't think their Shoresig Demons covered themselves in any measure of glory at all. But Jesse Bernhardt especially, who we're going to get to later in another segment, just dude is so consistent. The one adjustment that was made in the championship game involving him, you know, bumping up to midfield to cover Mikey Schlosser and kind of force different looks in that game. I just feel like this is a guy that never really got enough credit, and he totally deserves it. He was, in my opinion, the best defensive player in the MLL this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned, his versatility is just having a guy on your roster where you can look at the other team and say, okay, where is the threat coming from? Oh, it's a midfielder? Hey, guess what? You're bumping up and covering him. You know, hey, it's like a big physical attackman. Guess what? You're bumping down and covering him. And Bernhardt can just do all of that, everything in between, pick up ground balls, knock down passes, just basically everything you want from a long stick. He's definitely, I can't agree with you more. He was such a game changer this weekend. And Kamizio Mazzone also cannot agree with you more. Those guys in particular, what was it, Mazzone to Kamizio for the game tying goal that sent it to overtime. Both those guys put together 6 ground balls each from those guys. Yep. In this one particular game. They were all over the place, playing on the wings, playing just amazing. Great job by them. I also, I you get this far in a season, I get disappointed that a team has to lose. I know it's Pollyanna-ish to say that kind of thing, but like at the end of this game, I was like, oh man, you know, it's like a show getting canceled or something. I'm like, man, no more Blaze games.
Yeah.
But those two guys are part of the reason why it's been amazing, fantastic, entertaining, get to see them play. So speaking of the Blaze, let's kind of talk, you know, exit interview style for this organization. You know, it's obviously everybody's goal to win more games than they lose. And you know, I guess technically they didn't do that because they're 500, made it to the playoffs and lost in the first game. But other than that, and I guess that is a big thing to overlook, but I feel like it was a huge season for Atlanta's progress, right? I mean, a lot of records were falling left and right, and not just because of the extra games on the schedule. You know, they finally brought in a face-off guy who was reliable both in attendance and performance. And I'm going to nominate their front office, along with Denver's, for my Front Office of the Year award that doesn't exist but should exist. Just basically, you know, not only the people that they were able to pick up, but guys like Stotts, guys like Matthews. I mean, Matthews they got for nobody. Stotts they got for, it was like a fifth round trade or something like that. It was, either way, made out like bandits in both of them. So my question to you is, what do you want to see from the team, the organization, the players, whatever, between now and like training camp next year to get them to take that next step?
So this is the point where all of you can see how different Chris and I actually are, despite us agreeing. Now, I'm going to say 90% of the time on this podcast on pretty much everything. I don't feel bad for them at all. I am absolutely done feeling bad for teams that play themselves out of a game on either side of the ball. This is pro lacrosse. Suck it up and deal, or just suck. We have been talking about the deficiencies of this Atlanta team all season, just as much as we've been singing their praises, I might add. And they never addressed any of it. Not once did I think to myself after the All-Star break, huh, you know, this Atlanta team, they really figured it out with that defense and subbing thing. Not once. So, while I can admire the hell out of their offense, and I do, I think their offense is incredible and has incredible players on it. I can also sit back and finger wag their failures with a clear conscience. It's not personal to me, even though I feel like I might have got called out at halftime of this game about saying all the bad things I said about their defense. And then I turned out to be right. So, sorry, not sorry, but kind of sorry, but not really.
That's funny. I was wondering when I was watching that if he was talking about me or you, because I wrote the preview about it. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I didn't point out the numbers. It was impersonal. But because he was like, yeah, they're all saying we suck. So, yeah, you know, do us a favor and specify who you're talking about.
You know that they don't look at who writes the articles, right? Like, literally, no. That's why everyone thought that I wrote half your stuff and they thought you wrote half my stuff all summer. They're just, oh, it's on IL. It's one of them. Maybe it's both of them. It's a little irresponsible. Help us out. Come on. Seriously. Right?
Yeah, we got to know these kinds of things. Absolutely. As for me, I want to know, I guess it's not like a in-house sort of thing, but I want to know how they're going to get more people to these Blaze games. And honestly, maybe it's just not that big in Georgia. Maybe lacrosse just isn't really there to take a hold right now. Maybe that's defeatist, but I feel like that's pretty much ignored all the time when the conversation comes up about, you know, hey, let's, you know, grow the game, or let's do this, let's do that. And maybe there aren't really that many customers. That being said, it's wild to me to think that you can see that kind of talent in your city and you just don't. The Swarm have a similar situation indoors, but they do better numbers. Just, you know, the indoor game does better numbers. But I guess everybody's still trying to kind of crack that code to making pro field lacrosse something that you have to check out on a regular basis. I would just like to know what the plan is there. You know, what do they have in mind next season? How are they going to try to get some more people there?
I mean, I just hope they get a stadium that works so they can actually address the attendance situation, because they switched stadiums three quarters of the way through the season. And I liked Kennesaw. I went there for MLL Championship for a couple years in a row. But I also understand the problems with that location. You know, I think maybe they have to partner with some other local teams in the area and try to, like, cross-promote. And the thing is, like, I have kind of a unique perspective here in terms of just you and I talking about it, because I have a few friends that live down there, and some of them have kids. And I think that community is there. The support is there. I just think they haven't harnessed it. And I think they're capable of doing better, but I don't know. I hope every lacrosse community does their level best to support all the teams in their area, local or not, in whatever league they have. But maybe you're right. I hope you're not. I kind of think you're partly right, but also maybe just better marketing will help them out a little bit more. I don't know. I see a lot of great things about this Blaze squad, despite just, like, totally taking them down in my last kind of rant. But, you know, I you asked me if I felt bad, and no, I don't. So,
and a rapper. They need a rapper. The Swarm set the put the bar down. They got 2 Chainz out to a game. Atlanta Blaze needs to respond. It doesn't even have to be a rapper. They need to get some celebrity out there at a game.
Yeah, I mean, what's like, isn't like Master P and Lil Romeo out there? Let's throw it back, right? They're ATL, aren't they?
I think they're Louisiana.
Oh, well.
But if I'm wrong, I'm going to feel like a real
jerk. I mean, you would know and I wouldn't. This is kind of like, you should know that one over me just by basis of your new music knowledge, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, they are Louisiana.
All right. Then I don't have enough knowledge to... I want to say, like, Jaquan should be there, but I'm pretty sure Jaquan's not even relevant anymore. And I need to move on. Any
Lil
thoughts?
Nas X, maybe next year.
Okay, all right.
Maybe next year, you know, the Old Town Road will kind of fade a little bit, maybe.
Fade enough that MLL can afford it? Let's hope. Do you want to talk about the OT situation here and, like, how that all went down?
Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, your boy Matt Abbott, who we found out has asthma. Like, what? How does Matt Abbott have asthma? That makes no sense to me. The most trusted guy to run out of clear gets caught by the ride, turns the ball over, and gives up the game-tying goal. I mean, I was shocked that happened, and then less shocked that Atlanta turned it over and the Bayhawks scored on the very next possession in overtime, right?
Yeah, I mean, that seemed, you know what, that I try not to make one little thing feel like a, you know, a giant thing, but seeing human clear 1,000% success rate Matt Abbott get, you know, get tripped up and tumble to the ground, and then you got these new guys, you know, you got Camisio swarming on them like vultures. It felt like not the passing of the torch, but it felt like they were just grabbing the torch away from him, you know, like the future is now old man sort of situation. And I was like, oh no, is this how it happens? Like, is this how the Bayhawk, you know, I can't really say dynasty, but, you know, their sort of legacy gets stomped out. Like, this is how it ends a lot for a lot of these. A lot of times it's not pretty. There are hostile takeovers. And I was like, man, is this really what we're about to see? And it turns out, no. You know, the Bayhawks still put it together, and they still won.
Also, quick update. Jaquan is a St. Louis rapper. 0-for-2. It's that Shire education. I got done. All right, let's move on to the next semifinal. Denver 17, the Boston Cannons 15. I thought Boston had this. Scored the first 5 goals of the game. I felt like they had it right up until Kyle Denhoff got hurt, and then Kyle Jackson went down, and the whole game changed entirely. Cannons offense was rolling against a very, very slow to start Denver offense that played maybe their worst first half of defense all season, or offense all season. Poor passes, poor shots, gumballs from Morocco to eat up and distribute to streaking midfielders. I want to stress how in control Boston was for the entire first half. And then Chris, then Junior happened. 44-year-old John Grant Jr. put the damn game on his back, scored three straight goals in the third, and the game flipped all the way back to the Outlaws. It was incredible. Chris, what were you thinking when you saw Junior score that first nonchalant BTB on the crease?
So, like how I was just saying about the end of the Bayhawk game, and you know, I didn't want to like make a mountain out of a molehill, but I felt like I was definitely going to do that. The Junior thing was the opposite, because like it would be totally reasonable for me to say like, you know, I felt the tide turn, I felt the seas changing, this and that, this and that, but it would also be totally disingenuous. I didn't feel any of that. I wasn't thinking a thing. I was just like, oh boy, what's going on? Is this... All I could say were little, tiny, stuttering, stammering sort of like, wait, hold on, is this really?
Yeah.
And it just kept going like that. And even when he scored again, whew, it was just actually seeing something like that come to life. You know, like after all these years, and you can still... I mean, it's insane how reliable this has been. Obviously, there have been high points and low points this year, which I think are totally reasonable to expect when a 44-year-old comes out of retirement and is, you know, playing a post game against people half his age. But he's burying a shot like that, and you get, like, not so much to, like, fan out, but you're like, wait, do I get to see this once again?
Yeah.
And so that's what I was thinking. I kind of went blank for a little bit there.
I was writing the recap for this in real time and had to erase a very large paragraph because of this, because of his antics. So part of me is like, come on, man. But part of me is like, wow. I like you kind of like, I feel like all of us watch sports at different parts of our lives and like, one of the things that happens when you get older is you start to recognize what greatness actually looks and feels like. You think you know when you watch something when you're like 20, and then you watch something happen when you're 30, and then you pass 30 and you have like all this kind of sports experience to call upon, to measure against. And there's nothing more to say about it other than Junior's still great. And this was proof. I do want to kind of give Denver a little credit as well. I don't want to gloss over the contributions of Denver's D-mids. Stuart Hayes and Begley flat out won this game just as much as the offense did. That trio is the best in the MLL, in my opinion, and this game totally confirmed that. And the championship game didn't erase it, but a couple key errors by at least one of those players should give me pause, but doesn't. I think one of the things that they all do is so well is they track back, they know when to sub, and they know when to stay on. You know, that's kind of like it's a bigger part of the pro game than anyone realizes, that knowledge of when to press, when to pull out, and when to move it down to the attackman, and when to advance to the goal. All that stuff is split-second decisions of you reading the game as a defensive midfielder that don't get enough credit and are more important in the pro game than college. Those guys are the one kind of constant during Denver's run here, and I think they deserve to be recognized. You know, other players went up and down in their effectiveness and impact, but not those three. So I wanted to kind of shout out those dudes while we're here. For Boston, you know, this loss is absolutely a heartbreak, but it's also one that they can easily pin on the loss of two guys. They shouldn't, but they can. What do you make of that kind of rationale, Chris?
I see how they would. I think the biggest sort of, I guess, inconvenience for that sort of thing, you know, not to make it sound too callous because it's an injury, but they did have to restructure, like, the subs and stuff like that on the fly. And then, you know, everybody else kind of has to pick up what they're doing, and you have to move everybody around. So from that regard, it's very difficult to lose two mids right away like that. That being said, I feel like when it happened in the game, you know, so like Boston's got the lead. They're up a 13-10 when it happens. They score the next goal. So they've already got 14 goals on them. It's not even the fourth quarter yet. And Denhoff and Jackson had chipped in one goal each. So I don't think they've been leaning on them so heavily that they were like, oh, now what do we do? You know, I feel like there are probably some people who are like, yes, this is why we lost. But I also feel like if you've got 14 goals, you know, halfway through the third quarter of a game and you've got the lead, there's probably ways you're going to win that game.
You got to win it in other ways. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously it sucks when a guy gets hurt and is out of your lineup, let alone two guys go. But, yeah, I'm not going to buy it 100%.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we saw after they went out is more pressure from the Denver poles on the Boston attack. And it seemed like at least a couple times from some of those caused turnovers, you know, Eli Gobrecht on Zed Williams kind of comes to mind with two helicopter checks. Those two guys in Denhoff and Jackson, they do space that side of the field pretty well. And I think that the guys that they had to put on there were like Goodrich, who's like dead tired after running. Like, I think Goodrich was on the field for like 6 minutes in a row at one point. That's not sustainable. It's just not going to work. And playing defense is more tiring than playing offense. Fact. That's a fact of life. If you think otherwise, I think maybe you're running around with the ball too much. But playing defense is much harder than playing offense. So I think the fact that they didn't have anyone to go to other that had two-way ability, really, other than Chalen Rogers and Goodrich, is an easy blame. But again, they made bad decisions with the ball and turned it over. So, and Denver was overly physical with them because Denver got away with it. Even though they got called for a bunch of penalties, they still got away with the majority of the fouls. Like, Denhoff got pushed from behind and drew a flag, but also like popped his shoulder out in the same play. So I don't know. It's a give and take with the physicality. In that way, I think that Justin Pugel would have made a huge difference for Boston if he had dressed, because he's like become their enforcer. You know, I thought Fahey did as good a job as anyone could do on Junior in the first half, but his teammates on defense gave him zero help in the second half. And that's a big part of how Junior scored those three goals and those key goals at those times. So in the end, Boston just got outplayed, out-physical, and lost the game the same way they lost almost every other game this season. Bad decisions early in the shot clock, even worse decisions late in the game. I do still want to give credit to Denver. They still had to stick those goals, and they still had to get past Morocco, who, I mean, he won the Dave Huntley Award right after this game the next day. And I voted for him to win it because I can't believe he wasn't nominated for Goalie of the Year. It's a travesty. And whoever set up those votes is wrong and was not paying attention to anything, because he is the best goalie in MLL to me. So, you know, it's again, this is where I do feel a little more sorry for Boston than I do for Atlanta. But at the same time, the same mistakes popped you out of the semis that you made all year. All year. So you didn't learn. And if you don't learn, you don't get to play for a championship. Speaking of which, let's go over 2019. Major League Lacrosse Championship, Chesapeake 10, Denver 9. I want to start out by saying that this narrative of the refs screwing the Outlaws out of a championship is wrong. However, I will say that the refs messed up a key call, if not two key calls, at the end of the game. Both of those sentiments can be true. the Outlaws, for those of you that might have missed it, the Outlaws were not granted a timeout when Eli Gobrecht clearly had possession of the ball in a scrum after Chesapeake had a two-man up situation. And how do I know that Gobrecht had possession? The shot clock reset for Chesapeake due to a possession change. And the Outlaws were not granted a timeout despite all their protestations that Tony Seaman was calling that timeout as soon as Gobrecht picked up the ball. Because that shot clock was reset and Chesapeake got the ball back, Andrew Q, D2 by the way, D2 stand up, scored the game winner in that new clock. You can't say that the Outlaws never had possession because you reset the clock. So I think that's the Outlaws deserve to be a little upset. And they were more than a little upset. But I don't think they have a right to throw tantrums on the sideline during a break in play and get one of their best players, Zach Currier, tossed, ensuring that they had no chance to come back afterwards. That was horrible. It was a horrible scene. I don't support it. I don't think it's a good look for the league. I don't think it's a good look for the Outlaws franchise. And I think that it kind of put a little bit of a black mark on this game. In the end, a whole lot of mistakes lead to a Chesapeake championship. I don't feel great about it. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, the end of the game debacle really put a sour note on what had been a largely, incredible, if not just flat out fun and, you know, high intensity and, you know, nail biter sort of game. You know, like Friday's games were, I had a great deal of fun watching them and, you know, talking about them and all of those things. You know, who knew what was going to happen? You know, all the stuff we already covered, the Blaze doing their thing, the Bayhawks fighting back, and Junior going off. We had so much great stuff to talk about. And then this game had its moments as well. You know, all this stuff, you know, we'll get into some of it later, but, you know, can the Outlaws come back? Can the Bayhawks hold on? All this stuff. And then it all, unfortunately, got a bit overshadowed by this just sort of meltdown at the end of the game. Like, you know, I understand the passion. I understand this and that. I also understand that there are, you know, good places and good ways to express that sort of thing. And basically, it all goes falling apart. And one strand comes loose, and now everybody who wants to pull on that strand starts pulling on that strand as well. So people who are watching this game but not talking about it, because that's how they do, there are people who, you know, kind of creep on this league. And the people who were creeping on the league all came up out of a sudden because they were like, hey, this league stinks. And they want to start, you know, pinning this sort of thing on that. It's a bad look. Everybody freaking out. And again, like, yes, we're saying you shouldn't be mad or anything like that. We understand that sort of thing. But it did make everything look terrible. Once again, another great day to not be a ref. I feel like this is going to be one of those famous sports things like Buckner and Steve Bartman, where history filters it all down to one moment and ignores all the millions of things that happened all around it, you know? Like, bad call. It certainly seems that way. You know, you'd have to hear from the refs. You know, maybe they didn't hear Tony Seaman, maybe whatever the case may be. This is also one of many times this year where they have had serious issues, the Outlaws in particular, with, you know, people running possession clock. You know, this shouldn't have happened, that shouldn't have happened. They had a bad year as far as this sort of thing, and I feel like it all kind of came boiling up in this absolute wrong time. But that being said, you know, Finn Sullivan had an unnecessary roughness for hitting Colin Heacock after he had passed the ball. You know, nobody made him do that. I don't think it was ticky-tack. I guess he could have pulled up, but, you know, you'll have to ask him on that. Nobody made Kyle Pless hit. I think it was Steele Stanwyck for landing on Dylan Ward's leg. And that was like 2 minutes left in the championship game. I understand the mentality and the notion, oh, that's my goalie. He's unprotected. I want to stand up for him. I think Dylan Ward would have understood if you didn't hit a guy after that. I think situational awareness would have been, you know, at such a premium where he would have been like, yeah, I get that. We're not going to go two men down. And even if they didn't score during that two men down, you know, that's you're going to have to play that on defense. It's not, you know, hey, two men down, let's go score some shorthanded goals. You know, they backed themselves into corners with some of these moves. I'm not going to say the refs were perfect, because I don't think they were. I think they called some things that maybe they shouldn't have called. I think maybe they didn't call some things. Maybe they should have. Was there a disparity? Absolutely. But again, certain things that are your control, you got to control them. And that's, I think, what got everybody in that sort of mess.
Yeah, and the Outlaws didn't do that all season. So why would they do it now? You know, I that's the truth of the matter. And I know a lot of feelings are hurt right now. I mean, one need only look at Denver Outlaws defensive coordinator Matt Bocklet's tweet after the game, where he added the commissioner and called the refs basically a joke. And I thought that, that tweet is still up. I just clicked on the link for it. I'm reading it right now. He's calling out the disparity in penalties, but why are you asking? And he asks the guy to find him at the end. Don't ask your boss to find you. They'll find you. Okay. If I'm out of here asking Inside the Cross to find me. I would have been fined a lot. Trust me. You know, I don't know what else to say about this game other than it was super frustrating to watch both teams' inability to grab the game and win it. This thing should have been won with 6 minutes to go by somebody. But instead, we got both of these teams throwing out junk offenses and defensively subbing to kill all the transition. I mean, yes, a close finish is nice. But the way this one ended does not sit well with me. I don't think it's just the refereeing. It's just a fundamental breakdown of what I think is an exciting game. I think it lacked a je ne sais quoi. You know, what are your feelings on how you felt going into the fourth quarter versus how it ended? Because I felt like two very different people in the same 15-minute span.
Yeah, I definitely felt that way as well. You know, just that loss came out so strong. Sorry, the Bayhawks came out so strong that I felt like maybe it was over before it even got started. But when there was actually a point, I remember when Junior scores this shot around Warren Jeffrey, who's covering him, and they make it 8-7. Mike Schlosser comes back, you know, 8-8. I'm like, okay, this is, you know, there's something here. You know, we're watching the game at our respective houses and tweeting about it with celebrity guest live tweeter Bryce Wasserman.
Bryce Wasserman.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks for doing that. So we're all talking, and I was like, listen, if they get another one here and Adler does something, you know, this thing's going to blow up. This is, you know, this is amazing. But yeah, the whole everything sort of afterwards definitely took all the sort of the air out of it, took the wind out of the sails. It just, yeah, it was a mess. And, you know, you don't want the championship game and anything to end up like a mess. I do have to say this. I 100% agree with you regarding the tweet. Don't let anybody take your money. That's just advice for life.
Yeah.
You made the money. Don't give anybody a reason to take your money or to give you less money. Anybody can take that.
Specific tip. Don't let someone buy your student loan debt because they'll own you for the rest of your life like they own me.
Yeah, so you go. There you go. Criticizing your boss online is like a high-interest loan or something like that. Avoid it at all costs. I will also add this. As far as the referees go, I know three referees by name. Three professional lacrosse refs. I know a guy named Peter Buchanan. I know Matt Palem. And I know Mr. Abbott, who was the crew chief of these games.
Yep.
I know Buchanan because he used to work with me in my youth league around here, and now he does college games and these pro games, and I'm like, hey, all right, he's doing great. I know Matt Palem because he's Matt Palem. Syracuse goalie and all that stuff. Wears 44 even when he's reffing Syracuse, shout out. And I know Abbott because I know you don't mess with Abbott because the dude's got a short, short fuse.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I know who he is. I have since read some more stuff, and I'm like, okay, this gentleman has a long history of illustrious referee stuff. But I know him on the field because if you say something, you're going to give him a reason, and something's going to happen.
He does not play. The man does not play.
Not at all. So, I mean, I can't be totally surprised when things started going back and forth, but I am surprised by the extent at which they did. Zach Currier, not to make light of, obviously winning a championship is very important. It'd be important to all of us. He certainly seems to love winning championships. He's won like 14 of them in the past, you know, 3 years or something like that. Whatever was said or, you know, back and forth with those guys must have been something serious. But shout out to Zach Currier for, after getting ejected, still coming back out for the handshake line and then apparently giving away his helmet to a kid in the stands. I saw on Twitter the kid was like in his backyard later that day shooting around wearing Zach Currier's helmet. So despite, you know, all of this stuff that happened, he still, for whatever reason, I guess, could compartmentalize enough to go make some kid's day. And that kid will never forget that. So he did have that. So that's very cool by him.
I don't know how to talk about what this says about the league, though. In many ways, I think it means nothing. At the end of the day, kind of like you can read into as much as you want to, but I think this championship weekend was very important to the MLL, and the semifinals delivered, and the final was a mess. And that's something they have to live with. You know what I mean? And one of the questions I've gotten asked a lot, we've talked about them on this podcast kind of vaguely. We've had interactions with both of these leagues, both personal and impersonal and professional, right? We know people that work in there. We know PR directors, we know coaches, we know players. And at the end of like both of these seasons, we've kind of come to a point where we're reflecting, and a lot of people, the one question everyone wants to know is, who won? I don't know. Now, my answer is, I don't know, and I don't want to know. Like, one of the things that we tried to do here was be as fair to everyone and treat them with the same respect that they treated us with. And I will tell you, personally and professionally, I've had issues with both organizations. I think a lot of those issues are probably a little like more my fault and taking things very personally because that's who I am as a person. You know, heart on the sleeve, rage in the face. Like, that's how I live my life. For better or worse, like, that's the deal. But you also know what you're getting, and you also know I won't BS you on anything. So you take the good with the bad in terms of how that goes. But, I mean, listen, we finished the PLL championship pod 2 weeks ago. We had Stags on here. We had Jake Bernhardt. If you're wondering why we don't have any Bayhawks coaches or players in this episode, you can go ask the Bayhawks. I don't know what they're going to say to you, but you can go ask them. That doesn't mean that one is better than the other, but there's a reason that that happened, and there's a reason that we're sitting here recapping it to the best of our abilities, and part of that is because that's the best that we can do with the tools that we have been given, right? We love this podcast. We respect this podcast. We respect all the players, all the coaches, all the leagues, and I don't think that personally we got that back from everybody. And maybe that's like me being sour grapes. Like, why can't you show that respect to us that we have shown you? Because by telling the truth about these teams, by going at them even, by criticizing them, that is the respect. Like, if I didn't do that, if Chris didn't do that, we would have failed. And whatever you think of what we're doing here, you're listening to this now. That's a win for everyone. Like, you're still here. Like, thank you so much for still being here. You could have left a long time ago, you know? So, I don't think that this weekend is going to ultimately decide any fates whatsoever, except for maybe some players not playing in the MLL next year. And some, you know, same could be said about the PLL championship. I think there's PLL guys that won't play in the PLL next year. But at the end of the day, like, everybody has to put forth the best product possible. I don't want to compare championships to championships. And this notion of, like, the Whipsnakes playing the Bayhawks, like, it's not going to happen. And, like, it's not even cute to talk about. It's kind of, like, heartbreaking if you really think about it, which is what we really think about all this stuff. It's, like, all we think about. You know, Chris and I were talking before the podcast how we had to super compartmentalize so many things just to get stuff done. Like, it would have been really easy for either one of us to jump in on all of these crazy debates and arguments and this is better than this. But we tried to be as fair as possible, and hopefully you think that's what has happened. This is the final product. We're going to do one more segment, and then we're going to run ourselves out of here. But, you know, hopefully you guys have enjoyed this. Thank you for listening to everything. Chris, do you have any kind of parting words for the audience before we move on to the next segment?
Yeah, I'll piggyback on a couple of things you just said right there. I as well had a couple problems here and there with both leagues this summer, but unlike yourself, I blame them completely. None of it was my fault. In addition, for the people who do want to know who won, in all honesty, if you thought one league was going to win over the other, you probably still think that league won. People could get, like, a hot dog at an MLL game, and if somebody chokes on it, then people are going to go on Twitter and say, this is why the PLL is better. People were just being ridiculous because they just liked competing and being petty and being bullies and stuff like that. Both leagues did awesome stuff, and both leagues had missteps that I'm sure they're not happy about. And that's just the way that businesses go, and they're all businesses and corporations, and that's how they do things. But yes, big picture, had a great time. It has been a challenge. It has been fun. It has been an honor. I was talking to a coach the other day, and he was like, yeah, thanks for doing what you guys do. And I said, yeah, man, I'm really lucky to do this. This is silly. This is crazy to think that this is in any way bearing any sort of semblance to an occupation. And he said the same thing. He was like, I am very lucky to be a coach as well. So we're fortunate. We are fortunate that people want to interact with us and comment and chime in and contribute things. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate it all so very much. Let's go ahead and wrap it up.
With that, we're going to tease the rest of the articles to wrap up both the PLL and MLL seasons, starting with the PLL team of the season, which is made up of all of the additive properties of the PLL team of the weeks that we've been doing all season. That's right. We did those because we wanted to have the receipts in our hand when we brought these to you. And what we're going to do, we're going to tease out one guy who got the most votes and had the best performances, thus had the best performances from the team of the weeks that is in the team of the season. Chris, you want to take the first attackman here?
Let's see. Yeah, you know what? First attackman here, team of the week, might surprise a couple people. It might seem very obvious to a few people as well. We're actually going to go with Connor Fields.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we've certainly discussed a lot of things in the past few weeks regarding, you know, this performance or that performance, but it is impossible to deny the impact he had on his team and on the league in general, and he just kept popping up on team of the weeks. So there you go.
He finished with 6 votes total. more than any other attackman in the PLL during the course of the season. For midfielders, this is really not much of a tease, not much of a surprise. Tom Schreiber easily with, I believe, three more votes than the next closest midfielder, blew it out, basically made Team of the Week half the season, which is, and we did the Team of the Week last year for MLL. That's unheard of. That's wild. I think there's only one other player in both the leagues that did that. And if you watch Tom Schreiber play, you know why. He's the man. He's the guy to beat. He plays the midfield position differently than anyone else. He is a killer. He can beat you in a million different ways. And I think it's really awful that he got hurt in the semifinal and couldn't kind of bring his team to the next level in the final of the PLL Championship. But it's another topic for another day. Chris, who was the defenseman with the most votes? This will be a surprise.
Let's see. If we scroll down and take a look at some defensemen here. How about Bryce Young?
Yep.
Not the flashiest of gentlemen. Not the most PR pushed in front of us of the gentlemen. But this guy just got results. Did a constant presence and close down low. I mean, cleaned things up exceptionally well. That's what I've harped on all year about what those guys do down there. The Whip Snakes keeps it clean, minimizes second chance opportunities. Did that better than any. And he finished with, I'm thinking, 7 votes. Is that right?
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Good for him.
All right, for the rest of our PLL team of the season, you have to check out Inside the Cross later this week. It will come out after this podcast, so if you're downloading the podcast on Wednesday, it'll be out either the next day or Friday, depending on how we lay stuff out. Let's move on to the MLL team of the season. Chris, who is the attackman with the most votes? This is not who you think.
Attackman with the most votes from the Atlanta Blaze, Randy Stott. You know, you give the guy the keys and he delivered time in, time out. And again, missed like a third of the season, which makes this even sillier.
Insane.
But yeah, the guy produced. The guy just constantly produced.
And, you know, just kind of a reminder, the team of the weeks were guys that had the best stat line of that week. If there was a tie or a judgment call to be made, Chris and I made it together, and we took turns making PLL and MLL, so we kind of had equal footing there, and that's a crazy result. However, not as crazy as I think this guy has the most votes of anyone in either league for midfield, and that's Brian Cole, also with 8 votes for midfield, which is half the MLL season. This dude was incredible. I mean, perfect combination of size, speed, power, lefty dominance. Like, the guy knows how to get to cage, knows when to push the ball, is just beyond anything else. I think one of the things that people don't talk about with him is he's smart, right? He doesn't take junk shots. He doesn't take dumb shots just because he has the ball. Right? He's looking for that other guy or someone in a better position. And if it's not there, he's going to take the ball to the net, beat his man, and get a key goal. Again, one of the guys that was a pleasure to watch, pleasure to cover, pleasure to write about all season. Chris, who we got for defense? Also a surprise, I think. Although we talked about it earlier, so not really. It's a little tease. Double tease.
Right, there's the possibility that you may have forgotten what we were saying earlier about this gentleman. If that is in fact the case, it's going to be a surprise. Jesse Bernhard pops up on the list with 5 weeks on the team of the week. Just the stuff we were saying earlier, and just times 5 to that. Dominant, versatile, even scored a goal or two here and there. Just a menace on the ground balls, just relentless, never gave up on plays, just a solid motor, kind of just a bunch of Bernhard traits, I think. And yeah, he was fantastic this season.
Yeah, so for the rest of all of our teams this season for MLL, you know, again, check that out later this week on Inside the Cross. We're going to bring this bad boy in for the final landing. some people's favorite segment, most people's least favorite, the recommendation of the week. For those of you that kind of follow Chris and I on Twitter and have been listening to this podcast, reading our stuff, it should come as no surprise to anyone that Chris and I are huge fans of The Ringer's Shea Serrano. However, we are but simple lacrosse scribes and thus have been putting off buying his new book, which is called Movies and Other Things. It's available right now when you're listening to this because it came out on Tuesday. On Monday morning, Chris replied to a tweet from Jonathan Abrams, a former colleague of Serrano. And I piggybacked off his tweet about giving free copies of Shea's new book away. And now I'm happy to say we will each have fresh copies of the book. So thank you, Jonathan Abrams. We are very grateful. And I can't speak for Chris, but I have a rule against paying over $15 for a book. I just kind of don't do that. I have similar rules for other things in life. So that's why getting stuff for free is great, except for shoes, because I'll buy whatever I want. And you know this. It's a problem. But I couldn't pick a better way to start the week than getting a free book that I wanted anyway and probably would have tried to talk someone else into buying for me. So thank you so much, Jonathan Abrams. And thank you, Chris, for doing the initial reply. Like, shout to you. I just tried to make a joke out of it, and somehow it worked. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was a great way to kick off the week. I was going to buy the book when I got home today, so I saved myself the time and the trouble. And also, I will just know, like, I have two Jonathan Abrams books on my shelf, actually, oddly enough, right next to the Shea Serrano book, Basketball and Other Things. So it's pretty cool that I will say, oh, this one came from Jonathan Abrams. So yeah, thank you to him, because that was awesome. He was just like, hey, I have some books. Who wants them?
Yeah. He just sent me a DM, asked for my address. I gave it to him, and he said, I got you. Which, it's like a warm hug in a DM, man. I'm not gonna lie to you. I felt good.
Yeah, man. Sometimes for all the toxic stuff, sometimes Twitter is really, really, really cool. And this was one of those times. Now, my recommendation of the week. So I've been watching a ton of movies when I'm not watching lacrosse, and now that lacrosse has, you know, come to a conclusion, I've been, you know, running through like 2-3 odd movies every weekend, stuff I've just been meaning to watch. And coincidentally, the two that I watched this weekend were both about people doing crimes. And I think movies about people doing crimes are fantastic. Just movies about them, I would not recommend any of you actually go out and do some crimes. That being said, I watched one that was based on real stuff and one that was fictional. The real one I watched on Friday was White Boy Rick.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yes, yes. A story I didn't know anything about, but now I know a lot about it. And I know there's like a documentary they made as well. So I'll be checking all that out. There's no real point in giving anything away, but basically like this high school age kid who ends up kind of working with the law and also becoming like a kingpin and just getting mixed up in a bunch of stuff. It's crazy and it's true. So check that out. And the one I watched on Sunday, which, you know, you might have seen it because it came out 10 years ago. Inside Job.
Yep.
No, sorry. Inside Man.
Oh, yeah.
Inside Man. I had not seen it. So I took care of that. Clive Owen, Jodie Foster, Willem Dafoe. It's directed by Spike Lee. He's one of those, it's a heist movie.
You buried the lead. Denzel's in it, man.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
We do it.
Denzel's in it. Yeah. I'm naming all these people who are like playing waiters and stuff like that. No, Denzel's in the movie. If you haven't seen it, if you're like me and you just let it go by for 13 years, actually, without seeing it, go fix that as soon as possible. Nothing beats a good heist movie. And, this is in fact a good heist movie.
This podcast is basically a heist movie at this point. I'm going to be honest with you. Because we got away with some stuff. We got away with some stuff. I can't let the podcast end without asking you a very important question that I think the audience needs to know the answer to. Chris, you've been talking about these Oreos all summer. What is the best Oreo?
Ooh, so the best So, yeah. So, do you mean the best that, like, you could go to a store right now and get? Or the best that, like...
All time. The GOAT. The GOAT Oreo.
Ooh. Okay. So, they had a cinnamon bun flavored Oreo that was a limited edition, but was crazy, crazy good. I might say cinnamon bun is the GOAT Oreo. That being said, the mystery flavor right now, I can't stress this enough. Somebody was talking to us on Twitter about how we kind of nailed some predictions, I guess, during the weekend games. And they were like, I should maybe go check out this mystery Oreo thing, too, if you guys are kind of high right now. Yeah, mystery Oreo is fantastic. It is really, really good. Cinnamon bun is probably the all-time favorite. S'mores come around every year, and they are also exceptional. So if you've screwed up the past two summers and haven't copped some s'mores, you have something to look forward to next summer.
Also, I want to apologize to the entire Atlanta hip-hop community. T.I., Gucci Mane, Jeezy, Ludacris, 21 Savage, Jermaine Dupri, Outkast, Little Yachty, I don't like you, but everyone else, my bad. I messed up earlier. I feel awful. And I can't believe I have all these names now and did not have them when I needed them. So that's why we write the rundowns and kind of script a little bit of the podcast. And I dropped the ball there. But hey, we're all having fun. Chris, where can people find you on Twitter prior to the start of the next pro season?
You can find me at ChrisRosie22.
You can find me at the Kyle Devitt, trying to defend myself all the time. I did tease that on Twitter that Chris and I might be reuniting for another project. So if you want that, if you want this podcast about, D1 lacrosse, you know who to talk to. Talk to the people upstairs. Let it be known. Let the voices be known that you want to hear that. You want to see that. And we will do our best to make it happen. Thank you for running with us all summer. It's been wild. If we offended you, sorry, not sorry, man. We had a lot of fun, and we're just going to keep doing what we do. And thank you so much for everything. See you next year. Right up to the party.